This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
Y bueno, pues estamos a la espera de cómo están siendo esas manifestaciones, esas protestas que a lo largo de toda la jornada de hoy se están realizando en esos cuatro países.
¿Qué es lo que están específicamente protestando la comunidad migrante en Europa?
Estos años de crisis han surgido mensajes desde el poder político y también desde los discursos mediáticos que están diciendo que ya no es necesario que haya un exceso de inmigrantes. Por ejemplo, esta jornada que hoy se vive, que ha sido impulsada en Francia, viene propiciada por unas declaraciones del ministro del Interior francés, el señor Brice Hortefeux, que había ironizado sobre el exceso de inmigrantes en Francia, sobre todo agudizado por época de crisis. ¿Y qué es lo que está ocurriendo? Bueno, hay muchos inmigrantes en situación irregular en Europa que están viendo cómo se les persigue policialmente. Se están produciendo redadas también en la calle, gente que no ha cometido ningún delito, se les solicita los papeles en la calle, como no los tienen, son privados inmediatamente de libertad, son trasladados a centros de internamiento donde se les tramita la expulsión del país. En muchos casos, como eso cuesta mucho dinero, expulsar a tantos inmigrantes, no pueden ejecutar la expulsión del país y lo que se hace es se les da una carta de expulsión y se les deja otra vez en la calle, con lo cual la vulnerabilidad y la marginación en la que caen todas estas personas pues es todavía mayor. O sea que la situación es esa básicamente, ¿no? Mucha criminalización en general de la inmigración, mucha vinculación de los hechos delictivos con la inmigración y sobre todo la persecución a todas esas personas indocumentadas que están en países europeos. Donde más se está viendo esa persecución son en países como Italia, donde se ha hecho una ley muy dura contra la inmigración, en Francia y también en el Estado español, donde supuestamente hay un gobierno que se autodefine como progresista, pero donde estas redadas, estas detenciones y estas expulsiones se están realizando.
Acaban de escuchar al periodista español Rafael Cuesta. Hemos llegado al final de otra edición del Informativo Pacífica. Nuestro agradecimiento a Telesur y a la Radio del Sur de Venezuela, a Más Voces de España y a Radio Tierra de Chile. A nombre de Fernando Velázquez, se despide Norma Martínez.
Este y otros programas del Informativo Pacífica pueden ser escuchados o descargados en iPad o en forma tradicional en www.kpfk.org. en los archivos de audio.
También pueden escuchar el Informativo Pacífica de lunes a viernes a partir de las 9 de la mañana en los archivos de kpfk.org. Búsquenos bajo el nombre Informativo Pacífica en Audio Archives.
It's dead of winter in the mid-Atlantic. As we navigate snow, ice, and numbing temperatures, you're probably thinking of much milder climes. But as you plan that tropical interlude, have you ever asked yourself, just how sustainable is my vacation? Esther Figueroa's award-winning documentary film, Jamaica for Sale, asks this very question and more. Come to a screening of the film and a discussion with the filmmaker at 6:30 p.m. on Friday, March 5th at the 6th Street Community Center, 638 East 6th Street between Avenues B and C in New York City. Again, that's Friday, March 5th at 6:30 p.m. at the 6th Street Community Center. For more information, call 718-789-9177. That's 718-789-9177.
WBAI would like to thank the following food donors for their generous donations during our winter fund drive. Alpha Noose Middle Eastern Cuisine on Maiden Lane. Tandoor Palace Indian Restaurant on Fulton Street. Papa John's Pizza on John Street between Broadway and Nassau. Moustache on East 10th Street in the East Village between 1st Avenue and Avenue A. They also have a location in Harlem. Wall Street Wine Merchants on Pine Street. Please remember to thank these donors donors for supporting WBAI when you visit their establishments. We also like to thank Matt Mazza, Mitch Cohen, and Indra Harder from the WBAI Cafe for providing meals for our amazing volunteers.
And as if that wasn't thanks enough,
WBAI would like to thank the following food donors for their generous donation during our winter fund drive. Veronica's Kitchen, 601 Williams Avenue in the Prospect Heights section of Brooklyn. La Gran Via Bakery, 4516 Fifth Avenue in the Sunset Park section of Brooklyn. Red Jacket Orchards, 957 Routes 5 and 20 in Geneva, New York. Please remember to thank these donors for supporting WBAI when you visit their establishments.
In a world of trouble,
waves of attack on immigrants sweep through South Africa. We want them to leave.
England's in a crisis.
In a world of independence.
Costa Rica Central, hola amigo.
In a world of relationships.
Oh gosh, you scared me. Tariq, you're not funny.
Did you think this little monkey was going to eat you?
People are looking, stop it.
In a world of heroes.
Austria, I just want to gather the villagers to inspire them to rebuild.
If you won't send the images and forward me the feedback, I quit.
Who are these people?
They are the aliens.
Discover where they come from
and what obstacles they face.
Listen to the exciting new radio drama series airing on WBAI 99.5 FM starting Saturdays at noon, March 13th. Visit us online at thealiensseries.com.
Safe house is a slang term soldiers used to describe where Taliban lives in villages. They got those terms from a radio.
In a world of trouble,
waves of attack on immigrants sweep through South Africa. We want them to leave.
England's in a crisis.
In a world of independence. Costa Rica Central, hola amigo.
In a world of relationships.
Oh gosh, you scared me. Tariq, you're not funny.
Did you think this little monkey was going to eat you?
People are looking, stop it.
In a world of heroes.
Austria, I just want to gather the villagers to inspire them to rebuild.
If you won't send the images and forward me the feedback, I quit.
Who are these people?
They are the aliens.
Discover where they come from and what obstacles they face. Listen to the exciting new radio drama series airing on WBAI 99.5 FM starting Saturdays at noon, March 13th. Visit us online at thealiensseries.com.
Safe house is a slang term soldiers used to describe where Taliban lives in villages. They got those terms from a radio.
The Left Forum is coming. Join thousands of people for the largest annual conference of the U.S. and international left.
From Friday, March 19th through Sunday, March 21st, come and be part of the dialogue with an amazing diversity of activists from around the world.
With more than 200 panels and 600 speakers, you can listen, talk, and exchange ideas, as well as challenge the tone of an administration that has failed to deliver justice, hope, or change.
And for the first time, Reverend Jesse Jackson and Noam Chomsky will come together in the same conference. Jackson as the keynote speaker and Chomsky addressing the closing plenary session.
The Left Forum is an annual gathering that affirms the diversity of left, progressive, and radical voices.
Friday, March 19th through Sunday, March 21st at Pace University in downtown Manhattan.
For more information or early registration, call
212-817-2002 or log on to www.leftforum.org.
See you there. The Left Forum is coming. Join thousands of people for the largest annual conference of the U.S. and international left.
From Friday, March 19th through Sunday, March 21st, come and be part of the dialogue with an amazing diversity of activists from around the world.
I feel like I'm in a loop here, an endless loop of Left Forum. Golly, I can hardly wait. All right, well, it's 12:09. You're tuned to WBAI New York. Send food! WBAI New York, and it's time now for a very special edition of Night Shaft without Mike Sargent. Where life is like a cheap, low-budget horror movie.
This is Night Shift. this evening there's going to be a very special episode of Night Shift, which we do periodically, where I have a series of interviews. Since we're in a marathon for about a month, I have a series of interviews with composers, directors, actors from a series of films that are either in release or about to come out, and I'm going to play them to you here on Night Shift along with a little bit of Night Shift music. So I want you to sit back and enjoy the music you're listening to right now, and you heard just a little bit before. It's from the score to the End of the World film, Book of Eli, which is still in theaters now with Denzel Washington. Got a chance to talk to the composer, Atticus Ross, and talk to him a little bit about scoring this interesting film. All right, you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm here with Atticus Ross, who is the composer of the Book of Eli. Atticus, welcome to WBAI.
Thanks, Mike.
All right, now let me ask you a question. I myself am a big, besides being a film critic, I'm a huge movie score lover, and I'm just a big music lover. So for me, there's, you know, whenever I listen to, whenever I see a film, I'm very conscious of the score, and I was very conscious of, the music. I saw the film twice. The first time I didn't pay so much attention. The second time, when I knew I was going to interview, I was listening to the score and thinking about what you did. When did you know that you wanted to be a musician, and what does music mean to you?
Well, I actually knew that I wanted to become a musician much later, I think, than most of my contemporaries who've ended up doing music as a career. But I'd grown up around music. You know, my dad started Radio Caroline, which was the first and the big pirate radio station, you know, at the end of the 60s in the UK. And they used to broadcast from a boat. So it was kind of like, you know, and a lot of his friends were involved in music and blah, blah, blah. And then he went on to have a nightclub. And, you know, I was around music, but I didn't feel like I didn't feel that gifted in terms of an instrument. Like, I could play, but I didn't feel like I was as good as friends of mine. And then when I was about 21 or something like that, I bought a drum machine, and I just sort of became very obsessive around it. And then, you know, went on and bought a synth and this and other, and then just, you know, like all things in my career, I think it's just been kind of lucky, and, you know, things just kind of fell in place. You know, I ended up with a development deal with Island Records, you know, pretty early on, and just kind of, you know, it just became my life in a way. And in terms of what it means to me, I think, you know, music, you know, is really one's companion through life. You know what I mean? And I think that it's, you know, it took me a long time to be able to express myself in a way musically that I felt, you know, the sound in my head, if you like, coming out of the speakers. And in the last few years, I've just feel a lot more confident in being able to marry the two. You know what I mean, Mike?
Sure. No, I know exactly what you mean. And I'm curious, for you, your evolution as an artist, are you able pretty much to put down tonally what you hear in your head? And has that process just gotten easier and easier?
It's gotten easier and easier as I think I've become more, you know, obviously, I mean, for me, I think experience is the big thing, you know, in terms of, you know, in my case, you know, it's like there's an aspect, sometimes you hear someone and it's their first record and it blows you away, and you know what I mean? There is always that aspect of the immediacy, but in terms of what I do, I think it's like I've been very lucky to work alongside, you know, some real musical adventurers, and particularly Trent Reznor, and, you know, the last couple of years we've been working together. You know, and it's always the case with him, and what I try and do in whatever you know, whatever I'm doing. You know, it's like sometimes I read about people and their producers or whatever, and it's like, yeah, well, we made a hit with this amp, so we're going to use it on this and this and this and this, and, you know, rather than that thing of, you know, we're going into a new project, how can we make it different? How can we make it more exciting? How can we, you know, it be a challenging thing? And certainly within the film context, I'm such a novice that even the idea of doing a film is a challenge for me.
Well, now, I'm also curious, based on your background as a musician and working, like you said, with Trent Reznor, I mean, Trent is someone who does music that the music itself, you know, is telling lots of stories and is rich and has lots of depth. For you, what do you find either rewarding creatively or limiting about the both the creative freedom of writing a score and then the constrictions of having to time it to the pacing of a film or a scene, or, you know, give me something that says, you know, whatever emotion?
Well, in this case, I'm working with the Hughes brothers, which I've done a few times now. You know, the idea, the sort of, there's a real emphasis on the creative process. I mean, I know they're not musicians, but they're very musical people. And I think what's, you know, I don't have the experience with lots of directors, so I don't know, but with them, there's an aspect where you write, you know, a fairly substantial amount of music before anything's shot. And they actually go into the shoot with CDs of the stuff they feel, you know, is kind of, you know, like the stuff that in this case, the main theme, for instance, was written before anything was shot, you know, and there's a few other pieces, and they make these CDs, give them to the actors, and just try and evoke the world that they're in beyond just, you know, the sets and whatnot. And they had, you know, we had the script, obviously, for a while before. Then they did this lookbook, which was very detailed in terms of imagery, and they assembled these various quotes from, you know, pretty diverse sources. And they had a good idea of the world, you know what I mean? And then
sure.
It was a case of trying to make the musical companion to that. And there's a lot of coffee drinking and talking and swapping of albums, DVDs, whatnot. So in that bit, it's really like there are no constrictions. You know, all I'm trying to do is evoke this place that we're talking about, you know. And in this case, you know, there's the obvious kind of, you know, reference points in terms of, you know, what this is about. You know, the post-apocalyptic nature is just the setting. You know, the story is this journey, you know, the journey of a man spiritually and physically, you know. So, you know, certain stuff was written, and then as the picture starts coming in, obviously everything changes. You know, in this case, it was really trying to, the stuff that took some time was trying to give Gary Oldman a sound, which he eventually came to with that low brass. And in terms of, like, the specifics of with picture, you know, it's a mixture of stuff. You know, like I say, we wrote, you know, a fairly substantial amount of material. In some cases, it would just be re-editing that to the picture. In other cases, it might be, you know, writing specifically to that. Or this is the right world for it, you know, but it's not the right piece, you know, but we do have a roadmap in terms of this scene, and then just, you know, taking what we knew would work in terms of atmosphere and general direction, and then just tailoring it to the piece. But I didn't feel ever constricted, in a creative way, and I think that's partly due to their approach to filmmaking. You know, I've noticed, you know, and obviously in the last year, I've been paying a lot more attention when I watch a film to the music. And it seems like, you know, it's different strokes in different projects. Sometimes it really does feel like space-filling background stuff, you know, and then there are other directors, it seems, who really kind of push it to the front. And certainly in this film where you've got, you know, periods of Eli walking around, you know, there's time to really let the music do its thing.
With sure. Bucky. Well, there's definitely a sequence within the first 10, 12 minutes of the film after he dispatches some people who were trying to take his pack, where the music really, you know, kind of, to me, establishes itself as almost a character in the film. I'm curious now about the contrast of, you know, doing, you know, because you're primarily an electronic musician, or known for that, your remixes and production and whatnot, in a world that where technology is almost gone, how were you able to, or what was the approach to give a sound to this film that gave us, you know, a sense of this world and the atmosphere without it sounding too electronic or too modern, as it were?
Well, I think, you know, like you say, I kind of, I'm confident within the electronic arena, but I always, you know, there's an aspect, I think, of my work where it's a very much combined with an organic feel. Do you know what I mean? It's not
sure.
Pure electronic or whatever. And a lot of the pieces that sort of establish the, you know, the kind of early stuff, you know, it's kind of droning and atmospheric. Those are all actually made with real instruments. Maybe they're processed in different ways. And certainly there'll be some layers of synths. But the general idea was to kind of start more atonal. And I don't know if you noticed that, you know how washed out the film is in the beginning.
Sure.
Towards the end, as the color starts to come in more.
Yes.
You know, there is this idea of, you know, the humanity. And this sort of oversimplifies it. But just as a sort of starting point, what we're thinking was to try and, you know, keep this almost non-melodic thing that it opens with, and then, you know, melody enters, and then as time goes on, it becomes more and more human until you get to the point where they're rowing across the bay, and there's that moment where Solara takes the oars from Eli, you know, and that, to me, was where that's just the orchestra, you know, there's nothing else, everything else has been dropped, you know, and trying for that to be the most human moment, you know, there's a kind of lead line that we deliberately left, you know, because it's like when you're at Abbey Road or whatever, you know, and that was a totally new experience for me and mind-blowing one, it would have been easy to kind of, you know, well, let's make it sound bigger and, you know, we can have the whole section playing the melody.
Right, right.
And that. And, but the stuff that I felt good about was that, you know, we held back in those kind of places and kept the tone of it somewhat muted. You know, the lead on that piece is just a single cello. And I just felt like it made it more human sounding. So it was kind of like, you know, it just evolved as time, you know, as the whole process went on. But there was this kind of guideline of what we were trying to do from early on. And that was, you know, based off the conversation with the brothers and, you know, an overall idea.
Thank you.
been listening to an interview with Atticus Ross, who's the composer of the film in current release, Book of Eli, starring Denzel Washington, directed by the Hughes brothers. It's an end-of-the-world film that also stars Mila Kunis and Gary Oldman. Atticus Ross is the composer, and you're listening to the score right now, and I'm going to continue with my interview with him here on listener-sponsored radio WBAI. This is Still Mentioned Film. Also curious again because I really enjoyed the score and I enjoyed what you did and I enjoyed for me how different it was. I find that composers maybe who kind of come at things from traditional, like they study classical music and then they do movie scores, do things that are less, I don't want to say original, but less things that less surprise me than what someone like yourself who comes from maybe a different arena of music does. And I'm curious what your thoughts were in terms of what you can bring to scoring from the very beginning, from, you know, working with them on Touching Evil and, you know, from, you know, knowing where you come from. Because to me, what you've done, knowing I knew of you from all the concept albums you've done, from The Inevitable Rise and Liberation of Niggy Tardust and all kinds of things that you've worked on, I'm curious what your approach is and why you feel yourself being drawn to doing film scoring, or what it does for you that you, what you're able to do there that you couldn't do with some of the other work you've done.
Well, there's a few different things to it. I mean, one of them is, you know, I'm kind of drawn to the Hughes brothers as personalities. You know what I mean? Like,
sure, sure.
I think, you know, I used to think more that music you know, like, oh, if only I had that bit of equipment or whatever it was, you know what I mean? That certainly I still believe that ideas are the king, but the personal relationships that are involved with a project, to me, are as important as anything else, you know, because it's ultimately about communication, and that's whether you're working with a band or whether you're working with, in this case, directors. You know, it's about trying to collectively get something across, whatever that might be. And I do find that, you know, Alan's the one that kind of, you know, they're both very involved with the music, but they also divide up the workload as one would on a big film. And Alan is slightly more so involved, if you like. And over the different projects, you know, we've become friends, and I feel like, you know, we're able to be honest with each other. You know what I mean? Like, he's able to say, I think that sucks, and I'm able to say, I think that would suck if we did do that.
Right.
So I'm very into that kind of, I've found myself, like, that personal side of things is important to me, you know, and in terms of the actual writing process on the films, I mean, one of the things I really enjoy is, you know, that I write with my wife and my brother, you know, and obviously, you know, there's that closeness of family, and I'm also able to do it in my house, you know, which it might sound stupid, but there's a side to that that, you know, I do feel very comfortable working in that environment. In terms of what I think I could do more so in films, I'm just not sure. You know, I think that there's an aspect in terms of, you know, you're more free and you're more constrained depending on whatever it might be, you know, because one isn't tied to a song structure, obviously. And there is an aspect of, you know, being able to kind of carry an emotion, you know, and that being the ultimate, depending on the scene. You know, in this case, because we had such strong actors, it wasn't like, oh, this is sad, so we need some sad music. You know what I mean?
Right.
We were much, yeah. You know, I don't necessarily know, you know, obviously I've got no idea where the road would go. I mean, I think I can offer something, and I feel like that, you know, people, I've been really nicely surprised at how people seem to have responded to it. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It wasn't necessarily like I had a very clear, I mean, I had a view of what we were going to do for sure and how it was going to sound and, you know, like I said, these basic parameters. But really, I think, you know, there's an aspect to it when you talk about different composers where I am just naive, you know. So it's, you know, in terms of the experience of film and stuff. So, you know, even on scores that I love, you know, you get an aspect where you can see this piece has been written and reinterpreted here and reinterpreted there. And, you know, in this case, there's a couple of that, but, you know, there was a lot of writing done, you know what I mean? And so I think we were able to, you know, where one might have, with more experience, fallen back, oh, let's go back to this or go back to that, we were always, you know, going forward, if you like, if you know what I mean.
Sure.
And well, I just, you know, I would love to do another film. I would definitely love to do it. And I do think that, you know, we have something to offer in terms of the, you know, the genre. But it's one of those things, you know, where you just never know. You know, we'll have to see. And I do think that what is important is that personality thing, because I think in a different situation, we would never have been ended up in this situation. You know, it needed that belief from the directors and that kind of willingness to try something different and experiment and, you know, just they were kind of, I think that they're very brave filmmakers in a way, you know, in terms of what they specifically do and what they let everybody else do. Like, not just me, the whole team of people that worked on this. I think one of the things that they're really good at is letting people do what they're good at, rather than, you know, I've been in different situations where you're constantly being micromanaged and you never get to do what would have been good. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. Well, I also am curious for you as a, you know, you've made a career, I think, of making other people's music sound great. And I remember reading once somewhere how Korn was so impressed with what you had done, they had you go back and re-record every track of, because they weren't happy with what another, you know, producer or production entity had done. And I'm curious for you to be able to now, you know, you're front and center when you're the composer. And you're the composer for a film, like, you know, you may bring in other people if you wanted, but it's, as opposed to you in the background making other people's stuff sound great, it's about you. How does that feel, and what is the difference for you there?
Well, I think writing has always been a part of what I do, and certainly, you know, within, you know, the stuff that we've done with Trent, which I've done with him over the last few years, I very much feel a part of that. You know, so, yeah, there is an aspect where there are a number of projects where I just go in and it's just working with the material or the demos that someone's done, you know, hopefully trying to make it better. And then there are other projects where I'm actually asked to go in, you know, very early on, like, you know, within the writing process. So it's not quite as straight as, you know, here's something, make it sound good. The thing that I love about the, you know, or I love doing about the film was the aspect of just the writing, you know, whether... I never thought of it in terms of myself front and center, but I did, you know, I do enjoy that aspect of you know, of making music. You know, I just, it hasn't really made me feel one way or the other. You know, I'd never really thought of it like that.
So it hasn't made you decide, like, you know, you might put the production aside and become more of a straight-ahead composer. It's, you still enjoy being able to operate in both worlds.
Oh, very much so, yeah. I mean, I did an album after we finished The Book of Eli, or the second half of an album, and I started up, you know, another record in February. I mean, the thing with the composing stuff is, you know, it was a fantastic experience, and I'd really love to do it another, like I said, but I don't feel like I'm in that slipstream necessarily. Maybe we'll see what happens, but it's not like I've got tons of offers to do films, you know. It's one of those things that I think I've never really had a real game plan, you know, like, this is my career and I've got to do this and then I've got to do that and then I've got to do this and that'll take me there. You know, I've just kind of, you know, put one foot in front of the other. And hopefully, you know, within that, you know, put a lot of effort into whatever it is that I've done. You know, I think I do generally try and, you know, I always try and do the best that I can do. And hopefully, you know, I think that's very much the case with The Book of Eli, and it's one of those things where you just, now you've got to let go of it and see if something comes back, then great. You know, if it doesn't, that's all right, because I had a great time doing that, and I'm proud of the work that we did.
Well, I find you to be very... very humble about the work you've done and you're doing. And what's next for you? You mentioned this album. When is this album coming out?
I did a band called Sohees in Cambria. Their album is coming out, I think, in April, and then I go back with Bent in February. And I'm not exactly sure what we're doing, but you know, we're working together for a period of time and see what happens. I do feel very, you know, particularly the last couple of years where I felt brilliant in what I do feel very grateful for the place things have ended up. You know, I mean, and I think that for anyone to be able to do music is a way of life. You know, that's not something, you know, we can take for granted.
No, that's for sure. That's for sure. Well, I very much am curious to hear what you do next, and I enjoyed your score. I hope you do get a lot more offers, and I hope you have time. And I definitely enjoyed interviewing you. I could easily keep you on for another half hour. So, but thank you, Atticus.
Thank you, Mike. It's very nice to talk to you.
Give love. In a world of trouble.
Waves of attack on immigrants sweep through South Africa. We want them to leave.
England had a crisis.
In a world of independence.
Costa Rica Central, hola amigo.
In a world of relationships.
Oh gosh, you scared me. Tariq, you're not funny.
Did you think this little monkey was going to eat you?
People are looking, stop it.
In a world of heroes.
Austria, I just want to gather the villagers to inspire them to rebuild.
If you won't send the images and forward me the feedback, I quit.
Who are these people?
They are the aliens.
Discover where they come from and what obstacles they face. Listen to the exciting new radio drama series airing on WBAI 99.5 FM starting Saturdays at noon, March 13th. Visit us online at thealiensseries.com.
Safe house is a slang term soldiers used to describe where Taliban lives in villages. They got those terms from a radio play.
You're still tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, and on the web at WBAI.org. You've been listening to the music and an interview with Atticus Ross and his score for the Hughes Brothers post-apocalyptic film, Book of Eli, starring Denzel Washington. I got a chance, actually, to speak to Wesley Snipes for a new film he has coming out this Friday called Brooklyn's Finest. Brooklyn's Finest is an excellent, excellent film. It works on so many levels, and it's so well made. It's directed by Antoine Fuqua, who I also got a chance to speak with, and I'll play some of that interview to you as well. But Wesley Snipes plays a bad guy, basically, who's looking to possibly go good. Wesley excels at playing these type of characters. Wesley is most known for his action films like Passenger 57 and the Blade series, and first came to most people's notice with New Jack City and then a couple of Spike Lee films, Mo Better Blues and Jungle Fever. Wesley's always been someone I think has been better than a lot of the material, especially the action material he's gotten. He was nominated for a Spirit Award, for Independent Spirit Award, for The Water Dance, and really hasn't done work, I think, that's worthy of him in quite some time. A lot of his more recent films have been going straight to DVD. In this film, Wesley plays a great character and does it very well, and has a series of great scenes with another great black actor, Don Cheadle. Got a chance to sit with Wesley and talk to him a little bit about his career, what he's doing now, what it's like for him to do a film like this, and where is Wesley going? Where's he been? Where's he going? So stay tuned. Okay, you're tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm here with Wesley Snipes. Wesley.
Favorite station on the planet.
Welcome to WBAI.
WBAI, yes.
All right, I want to ask you two things. I want to ask you about your character, and I want to ask you a little bit about your career.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
I went with someone last night, and the first thing they said is, oh, man, Wesley, so good to see him back. Now, to me, you've always been, I guess I compare you to Sean Connery. Okay, in that I thought you were an actor that you took a lot of roles, especially the action roles, but you were always better than the material, so you could elevate the material. So my question is, in terms of choices you made for a while, you were balancing action with drama, you got nominated and won awards and whatnot. What made you make the choices you made in terms of going after being that action star? And at the time you were balancing it, like, what was your thinking? Where was your trajectory?
Well, the action star route was kind of a fluke. You know, I was acclimated and oriented to being a dramatic actor. And that's what I'm accustomed to from the theater, from my theater background. But after we did Passenger 57 and they got a chance to do some martial arts in it, it opened the door for the action. And then working in Demolition Man with Sylvester Stallone, that also opened me to the world and how much they appreciated action films. So I thought, and the strategy was, you give the dramatic fan base what they're looking for, and then you give the action fan base what they're looking for, and then hopefully the two will meet. It will cross over. They'll appreciate the work as a whole, and then they'll say, okay, the action fans will say, well, let me check out this drama that snipes all the comedy. And then all the comedy people say, well, let me check out the action. Some of the action we did overseas was an attempt to elevate the action in film and combine the dramatic elements to it, the dramatic foundation. I think that's why Blade worked, because it was more of a character as opposed and less of a caricature, and combined with the physical martial arts. That's the strategy. That was my agenda. Not necessarily in concert with everybody else.
I got you.
Some people, they just into it. You know, they make movies like they're selling toasters and hamburgers, you know. And that was the name of the game. But that's what I like to continue to flip back and forth and, you know, tap into all of the different markets that I'm appreciating.
Well, now, I'm curious also for you, again, I thought this was a great role, and I thought you were great in it, and I'm curious what the perception is, because as an actor, it's always about type, what you're perceived as, and what your last hit was, and I'm curious, Antoine, I'm assuming, picked you for the role,
right.
And, or you read, or you, you know, what
no,
was
he, it? He said he had me in mind as soon as he read it,
that's
and
it.
He picked up the phone and called me.
There it is.
Right, we've been trying to work together for 10 years, actually.
Okay, so my question is, that's what I assumed happened. With Hollywood in general, what is the perception and what do you think we maybe still have to do to change the perception of not just actors in terms of getting typecast, but African-American actors in particular?
Well, we gotta have more control over the product, and we have to create product that reflects the diversity of our artistic contribution and artistic strengths. We can't keep asking people to do for us. We can't keep protesting and marching because they won't do. That's energy that could be redirected towards doing for self and traveling around the world, seeing that there are people who appreciate our culture, how much our culture has influenced youth culture around the world. I know there's money out there, and I know there's opportunity.
I just got back from Russia. You
right.
would not believe.
Oh, I believe.
There are no black people in Russia, but hip-hop's there, there's graffiti there, the whole, you know.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, Danny Glover and I were touring, doing a location scout for Toussaint, and we were in Mozambique on an island, a Mozambican island. And here, you know, you got the brothers and sisters who are speaking Portuguese and then the Mozambican dialect as well. And they're walking around with, like, Tupac shirts on. You know? I mean, I'm looking at them seeing a 50 Cent, a cap with a 50. And when they came up to me, they'd say, oh, Blade, I'm 50 Cent. I'm 50 Cent. He's Tupac. I'm 50 Cent. It's like, wow. That's the power and the impact
sure.
of the culture being exported around the world. And there's ways to take advantage of that.
I agree. Well, there's a myth that films with black cast don't travel internationally. You want to speak on that myth at all? Because it's sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy.
That's not necessarily true. It's sometimes the in my opinion, the content, like certain local and colloquial phrases, terminology, language, you can't translate it. Mm-hmm. They don't understand it. There's metaphor built into it. There's simile built into it. And then some of the subject matter is really foreign to a lot of foreigners. So it makes it hard to digest. But in terms of their appreciation of us as a culture and the swagger we have and the dynamics and the history we have, they're about it 100%. Even more so sometimes than people here in our own country.
I agree with you. True story. All right, now tell me a little bit about your character, because I feel that you excel at playing bad guys who are masking a heart of gold, and good guys who have some bad in them. So tell me about this character and what your take on him was first.
Well, I didn't want to do Nino Brown too, you know, Nino in a different outfit. This Kaz is a guy who's had time to reflect. He has some quiet time, some shaking time. And he's realized that his earlier path was futile. That's what ended him up in prison for 8 years. He's bigger than that. There's more to his life than that. That wasn't his life purpose. And once he's out, he wants to pursue the human dream. Have a nice family, beautiful lady, be able to sleep comfortably without having one eye open, you know, less stress, and stop distributing death to his own community, being a contributor to the demise and destruction of his own community. He realizes that. A lot of cats who go through the lockdown experience come back with that insight. You know, interesting enough, I related to, like, being a martial artist and how we always talk about you having to go inside and finding the black dot and finding solitude. And in solitude, you can clear out and mute out all the noise, you know, so you start to think clearer. You can start seeing things from a higher elevation. Incarceration can do that for you.
You get tired of finding the black dot.
Right. Exactly.
Well, all right, I'm also curious, because you touch on a couple of things. As an actor and relating to this character, there's a certain amount of, to be a criminal, to be a successful criminal, there's a certain amount of posturing. You know, you've got to dress for the occasion.
Yes.
You know, whether you're hanging out on the street or whether you're making a deal with some uptown money. And so what's your take on that, and what was your approach maybe to playing this character? Like, you're an actor playing a character who's got to act sometimes.
Right.
You know what I mean? Right.
Well, I try to find the guys who exhibit some of those traits. You know, I look at the way they walk. I look at how they dress. That's how the braids came along. That's how the little diamonds in the ponytail came about. You know, a lot of the guys I know and have had as friends and as technical advisors, they are real smooth, they're real quiet, you know, until you light the fire, light that match, and then it's all hell breaks loose. But that's how I approach it, and that's basically how I try to build the characters.
All right, well, if you don't mind, tell me a little bit about working with Don Cheadle, because one of the big pleasures was watching two great actors do their thing.
It was a long-awaited dessert for me. I've been trying to work with a lot of the brothers and a lot of our best. You know, I've even offered, and our production company have presented projects for us to do together. And this was a great opportunity to work with Don. He's quick. He's a consummate artist. He's passionate. He's funny. And we have cultural familiarity. So that made it all like a beautiful experience for me. It's a lot of fun. A lot of fun. You forget that you're getting paid for having
right, right, having so much fun. All right, now I'm most curious now, what's next for you? I mean, I would think at this stage of your career, you know, there are a number of things you've done. There's a number of things you've accomplished, a number of things you can put in your hat. You have a production company, Black Dot, being one of the subsidiaries. And you've taken control. You know, even Blade, to me, was really you taking control of what Wesley Snipes is going to do.
Yeah.
So what's the next 20 years going to be?
Well, that's the agenda. We're building the institution now, building the foundation. I'm branching out into anime and animation. We have a fantastic project that we're bringing forward titled Ormandy Mech 5, which is a science fiction, futuristic science fiction adventure set with Africa being a now unified republic, and the family of warrior scientists are help to save the world from monsters. So I'm playing a little bit on that Blade urban superhero energy, and exploring the world of digital technology and film, digital filmmaking. I'm doing another project, and we're developing a project titled Master Daddy, which is a martial arts comedy, a family comedy, about the martial arts world and about a father who has one of the most beautiful daughters in the town and is neurotic and freaked out about any guy who shows any affection towards or any interest. And how he resolves his neurosis is he does all the things that we as fathers who have daughters wish we could do to a guy
okay,
who comes and steps to his daughter. I don't care if he's 11 years old or 91 years old.
Well, I can relate.
And he puts the martial arts on him. He puts the martial arts to use. So, you know, we're expanding. You know, we're doing very, very international, franchisable, expanding projects to show the breadth of what we can do.
All right, last question. For you, what place in your, as you might sound rote or banal, but what place in your life does martial arts come, and how does it help inform what you do?
Oh, it is absolutely, without a doubt, part of my life. It is the way of life for me. I even see acting as a part of the martial arts. And listening to, you know, like, a scene between two actors can be like a martial arts fight, like a competition. You know, you're looking for the opening, you're listening, you're watching your time, your timing is all about timing and rhythm, and then you try to throw the style in there. I relate that to the martial arts as well. So I do a little something every day. I've been training since I was 12 years old. I started all my children training. My wife trains. So everybody in the house trains. Martial arts is, it's a martial arts household. And it keeps me sound. It keeps me healthy. And I think it has contributed greatly to my longevity in the business.
All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Solid.
I'm going to come to BAI and talk about them, you know.
Gayland, lovely Dorsey.
It's a god-awful small affair to the girl with the mousy hair, and her mommy is yelling no, and her daddy has told her to go, but her friends are nowhere to be seen, and she walks through a sunken dream to the seat with the clearest view, and she's hooked to the silver screen, but the film is a saddening bore, 'cause she's lived it 10 times or more. It's about to be lived again, as they ask her to focus on sailors fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, look at those cavemen go. It's a freaky show. Take a look at that low man beating up the wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if you'll ever know. He's in the best-selling show. Is there life on Earth? Turn America's torture proud. Mickey Mouse has grown up a cow. And the workers have struck for fire. Cause Lennon's on sale again. See the mice in their million hearts. From Ibiza to the Norfolk Broads. Rule Britannia is out of bounds. To my mother, my dog, and clowns. But the film is a sounding ball. Cause I wrote it 10 times or more. It's about to be lived again. As I ask you to focus on daylights fighting in the dance hall. Oh man, you could guys get yourself. You could dance and show. Take a look at that. The wrong guy. Oh man, wonder if they'll ever know. He's in the
another film that's in theaters right now that just happened this past Friday is a film called Toe-to-Toe. Toe-to-Toe is a drama that's written and directed by Emily Abt. Unfortunately, another film that's in theaters right now that just opened this past Friday is a film called Toe-to-Toe. Toe-to-Toe is a drama, and it's written and directed by Emily Abt. And unfortunately, there are certain kinds of films I've found very often, sometimes with a black film, sometimes with films that deal with subject matter that, let's just say, many critics or the predominant, what the profile of a film critic is, may or may not get. And certain issues that are important that are touched upon and explored in a film would be marginalized by that critic. Toe-to-Toe is one of those films. It deals with a lot of issues that affect women, both black and white, and pretty much all races, especially here in America, and dealing with what it is to be a teenager and the pressures of being a teen at this time. I got a chance to speak with Emily about her film. It's a very, very interesting film. And it, like I said, it touches upon quite a number of things. And then I got a chance to speak to the two actresses who were in the film. The film is called Toe-to-Toe. I suggest you look for it, but take a listen. You tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, and I'm here with writer-director Emily Abt, who has a new film called Toe-to-Toe. Emily, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I have to say, one of the things that impressed me about this film, which is about two girls who end up being on a team together, but then end up, let's just say, being against each other or on opposing teams, as it were, is your insight into not only what it is to be a teenager, but what it takes to become a woman. So tell me, you know, obviously, you've gone through this yourself. Tell me how important this type of material is for you, because looking at your work, this seems to be a theme not only in your narrative films, but in your documentaries and the work you've done as an adult.
Yeah, well, I think I very much wanted to make a film that challenged the status quo on both sexuality and race. And race is definitely an ongoing theme in my work, and always been very interested, some might say obsessed, with race relations in America, and especially in the relationship between black and white women, because I feel like there's some unresolved tensions there. But, you know, more generally speaking, interracial friendships are, you know, not as common as we'd like to think in America. The New York Times actually did a series on race relations a few years ago, and they mentioned the statistic of basically that for 87% of Americans, their interracial friendships end at age 14. So I wanted to make a film that, you know, really explored why this was so. I mean, the film was very much inspired by some of my own experiences as well.
What made you choose not so much race, but there are a couple of what I thought were metaphors for, you know, growing up and coming into yourself, the whole idea of being in a competitive sport and doing something that, you know, helps define who you are.
So you're asking, like, why I chose lacrosse?
Yes.
And all that stuff, yeah. Well, Jesse and Sasha, like, for all their weaknesses, I think, are very strong girls. And you know, that's why the film is called Toe-to-Toe, because they're not afraid to go toe-to-toe with each other. And I think that some of that confidence that we see in them comes from playing sports. You know, high school team sports are something that girls in high school definitely bond over. And I liked showing the girls sort of engaged in an activity that, like, you know, is good for their self-esteem, because we know there are other things that the girls are doing that's not so good for their self-esteem. But I chose lacrosse specifically because I thought it would really help capture that sort of preppy East Coast world that the two girls are in. But, Yeah, and basically, I thought, you know, it'd be a nice aspirational thing because team sports is really good for girls' self-esteem. So I thought that was a nice thing to include.
Well, one of the other things that impressed me about the movie as well was the importance of having a maternal figure, or at the very least, the support and guidance of someone who's there who can help answer questions so that you don't have to go outside necessarily to peers or to peer pressure to be something or to answer questions that you have about yourself and the world. Can you talk to me a little bit about, you know, where one character has not so much the mother who's the driving force, but the grandmother, and the other character who may have many other things financially, but doesn't have that maternal power in her life?
Yeah. Well, a lot of people say that, you know, obviously if you don't grow up with a father, it's very difficult. But if you don't grow up with that strong maternal figure, it can be, you know, very, very wounding. And so I think the mother-daughter bond, especially for teenage girls, it's a huge thing. And so when there's issues within that relationship, I think, you know, a lot of young women really struggle. And basically, I think what Jesse does with that loneliness that comes from not having that strong mother-daughter relationship is she funnels it into acting out sexually. And basically the character of Jesse and her story really tries to raise questions about sort of the rampant sexualization of teenage girls today. You know, again, all this behavior of hers is sort of rooted in that missing mother-daughter connection. But I wanted to explore this because I feel like the whole, you know, let's get messed up and hook up lifestyle that we, you know, that's just so rampant in culture these days. You know, listen to any Lady Gaga, Keisha, Britney Spears song and you hear all about it. But, I think this trend very much endangers young women. So I tried to tell a story that showed the darker side of that lifestyle and that showed some of the, you know, that showed the roots to that behavior. And, you know, how young women can get hurt even when they think they're just having fun. So all of Jesse's sort of acting out that's, you know, seemingly just about having a good time is actually rooted in that missing mother-daughter connection. So it's, you know, trying to put a more sort of honest spin on all these good times we see young women having on television these days.
Well, sure. Well, I'm also curious, what was the initial impetus for this story? Because you come from a documentary background, and you chose this story to be your first narrative feature. So I'm curious, you know, where some of the inklings of this story came from for you.
Well, like I said, I mean, I very much wanted to make a film that challenged the status quo on race and sexuality. But I also, you know, some of this stuff was inspired by my own experiences in high school. I've had complicated relationships with my black girlfriends. And, I mean, the thing about Jesse and Tasha's relationship is that I wanted it to sort of inspire people of different races to be a little more, real with each other, even when that's awkward. I feel like, you know, sort of politeness nowadays is a real bulwark in terms of racial relationships really progressing. And what I love about these girls' relationship is that it's complicated and messy and sort of deals with the more subtle forms of racial tension that, you know, very much exist in everyday social relations, but that usually gets sort of overlooked by mainstream media. But, you know, some of the girls' conflict isn't even about race, but it gets amplified by the fact that they're from different backgrounds. But these girls are very authentic with each other. They don't always say the polite thing, and, you know, they're willing to have conflict with each other. And I think for me personally, whenever you can have that kind of honesty with a friend, that's where your relationship really gets elevated. So I'm trying to show the beauty and that sort of realness that these two girls have with each other, and we see ultimately that it's something they're willing to sacrifice a lot for each other because of it. So I tried to make a film that, you know, was sort of rooted in some of my own personal experiences, and you know, sort of hopefully create a relationship between these two girls that other people are inspired by.
Well, I definitely think you did a good job, and there are a number of issues that I thought you touched upon that were sort of just weaved into the story.
Another film that's
specifically
with
the Black family, where
Toe-to-Toe is
a drama, and it's written and directed by Emily Apt. And unfortunately, there are certain kinds of films I found very often, sometimes issues that I thought you touched upon that were sort of just weaved into the story, specifically with, you know, the Black family, where, you know, you have the matriarch figure of the mother, who in some ways is disappointed in the daughter, her daughter, who is the mother of the Tasha character, and who has taken on the role of mother for her granddaughter, and instilled in her ways to empower herself from things that could be, that.
I understand your question. I mean, you're talking about the relationship between Tasha's grandmother and her mother,
All right. Well, let me reframe. Let me give you the Reader's Digest version of that question. one of the elements in the film that I thought the film opens with, I didn't want to give away too much, but it opens with the Tasha character saying something that you're not quite sure why she's saying it. You see that it's giving her power, but you're not quite sure why. But then it becomes more of an indication of how her grandmother has taught her to view herself, and to, you know, which is something very specific, I think, within Black culture, to embrace what would have been a negative, whether it's being called, you know, nigger or whatever it is, and turn it into something positive.
Well, I have to say, I feel like that was a bold move on my part to open the film like that, because some of my Black friends have been like, you know, Emily, when I was watching the beginning, I was like, damn, did she really say that? You know, like, am I really hearing what I think I'm hearing? So you have to see the movie to know what we're talking about. But basically, you know, it's a term that's usually used in a derogatory sense, but both Tasha and her grandmother think of it as more of a sort of mantra, personal mantra, that helps inspire Tasha to be strong and do what she needs to do. I wanted to include that because I feel like women nowadays, strong women who stand up for themselves and others and are outspoken about their feelings, don't shy away from conflict, are often maligned. But ironically, being strong and outspoken and having confidence is oftentimes the only way you're going to get ahead in life. So as a feminist filmmaker, I thought I'd use that term in an empowering way, and have both Tasha and her grandmother be all about, you know, being strong.
Well, I thought it was very powerful because, as I had mentioned to you, I watched the film with my teenage daughter, and she got a lot out of it. And I was taken or surprised by, you know, just how frank certain things are, you know, for, you know, you always look, to me, I think you always, when you're older, you always look back and say, was I like that as a teenager? Or, you know, was I that aware of things? But I think today's teenagers are very much aware of their sexuality. They have a sense of body image and things like that. And I thought those were some very strong things that you covered and explored in this film. Was that part of why you wanted to do what you did?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I made a decision early on that we were going to kind of go there, metaphorically speaking, and I very much wanted the film to capture teenagers as they really are. And so, you know, kids and teenagers, they drop the F-bomb a lot, and they are engaged in sexual activity. You know, you read these articles. I remember reading one thing about how at this high school, sort of bland blowjobs are being given out, like handshakes and stuff. And I think there's a lot of sort of confusion around, you know, oral sex. Is oral sex really sex? And things like that. And, I mean, the bottom line is that kids are doing this stuff and talking this way, and I want to be authentic about that. And I think it sort of cost me commercially in some sense. Like, obviously, if we had gotten a nice PG-13 rating, then the film might be perceived more like a sort of Bend It Like Beckham and have a kind of under. But it was really important to me that this be an accurate and authentic representation of teenagers' lives today. So that included some sex.
Well, it did, and I also thought one of the other themes and things I thought that were obvious to me is just how easy it is to allow being promiscuous or exploring sex as a complete replacement for the affection and attention that you're looking for from someone more significant in your life.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think with Jessie's character, you know, I wanted people to see that it wasn't, that she wasn't just boy crazy, that it wasn't just about, you know, having a good time on the weekends. I wanted audiences to understand that this was really an escape for her and a dangerous one at that. So I'm hoping that people that see the film, you know, might kind of take notice of the Jessies in their own neighborhoods, that the schools that their kids go to, or in their friendship circles, and maybe reach out a little bit to those girls, because they may not be having as good a time as they appear to be.
Besides speaking to writer-director Emily Apt, I also got a chance to speak to Louisa Krauss about the character of Jessie, and then Sonequa Martin about the character she played as well. But first I spoke to Louisa Krauss. She's a theater-trained actress, and I spoke to her about the difference between doing theater work and doing film. Sometimes if you've just come off of doing theater, and then you go on to do a film, in a film, less is more. So what about having to pull back for film? Like you said, the camera's right there. It's going to capture everything, so you don't have to play it too broad. Do you ever find that a conflict, or are you able to switch back and forth very easily?
No, yeah, I'm really able to switch back and forth because it's the two mediums are so different because, you know, on a theater, you're on a stage, and you've got a house full of people watching you. You know, in the film world, you're actually in reality. You're so it's easier to... you know, what's the word I'm looking for? It's easier to adjust, you know, adapt to the surrounding. And that's what I think it's more about the surroundings, you know, when you're either doing theater or film. But the acting is always, the character is always going to be the character. It's just about adjusting to your surroundings.
Okay. So tell me a little bit about the character who you play in Toe to Toe and how you came across. You know how you came across, you know, the audition and whatnot, and why you what your take was on the character and why you think you got the role.
Yeah. Okay. So I my agency sent me the script and I read it, and after reading it, I loved it. I loved it. I thought I'm not going to be this girl. I didn't feel physically like the girl at all. I just thought, you know, I'm not this hot, sexy, like, lacrosse player, you know, and I thought, well, but what a great role. I mean, what a range of stuff I'd get to do, and what a rich character. And so I said, well, make sure they know I'm from D.C. I said, well, I'm from the D.C. area. And I actually knew the producer from the very first film I did. So I was hoping maybe she'd remember me from that. You know, I had a really small part, but, you know, I surprised everybody in that audition, and they ended up casting me as, you know, as somebody totally different from who I am, which is the case here, too. And thankfully, you know, I went in the first time, and I heard that they liked me. And then they brought me in again and again, and then I was offered the role, which was very exciting. I thought what a treasure of a part, you know, to be able to, you know, play sexy and troubled and privileged and really almost Greek in the end, you know?
Sure, sure.
I mean, and vulnerable, and you really, you know, even though she is this, like, self-destructive, you know, ready for a quick fix and addicted to, you know, self-destruction, basically, you see why she is the way she is, which is so, you know, gratifying. I mean, and I hope that other girls, you know, and you see, too, she's a really strong girl, and in the end she figures out what it is that she really needs, and she goes and she sets off to get that, and she also sets off to write herself, you know, and so I hope that other girls will see the movie and it will affect them, you know, to know that they're strong too. Everybody has a strength, and it's just about finding it and persevering.
Well, I agree with that. Now, how would you, did you ever know characters or women, girls like the character who you played? Did you draw upon anybody you knew?
I never thought of anybody real specific. I mean, there are a couple of girls who I can remember in high school, you know, who were like the loose ones and who everybody talked about, and there were rumors and stuff. But I wasn't really, I was... In high school, I was like everybody's friend. You know, I wasn't really popular, but I actually was prom queen, which is
wow,
really funny.
Okay.
because I think, you know, I was so nice to everybody, and I enjoyed everyone, and but I never really hung out, and I never really had any best friends in high school. My best friend in real life actually is my mom. I came up with a whole history for her, and I really made a real person to become. So.
Okay. Well, a few things that I enjoyed about your performance. I enjoyed what you did, and I tend to find this with theater actors. I enjoyed what you did with your body. There are a lot of things where you may not have had something to say, but your body language told me a lot about what you were feeling, what was going on for you, things like that. Tell me a little bit about how you use your body as part of to create the characters, unless I'm completely missing.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. This girl was very, you know, slouched and you could see, yeah, exactly. I mean, I love physicalizing my parts. That's a big thing. And I always think, you know, where's this person's center? And, you know, if I can think of any animals that I can, you know, think that maybe this, you know, what animal she would be. Or, you know, I always try to, you know, include a lot of details into whoever I'm playing. So they're realistic. And I think a lot of what has helped me with that is my whole dance background and the ability to really control my body so that I'm able to, you know, put on, you know, add some things and or take away some things from who I am to transform into another person. But I'm so glad that you picked up on that.
Another really good movie that's in theaters right now is a great film called 44-Inch Chest. And it's written by the same writer of another great movie called Sexy Beast with Ben Kingsley. 44-Inch Chest has a great cast, and it's a really interesting take on revenge. It's about a man who finds out that his wife is leaving him for a younger man, so he and some of his boys decide to capture that younger man. It's directed by Malcolm Venville, and it's a really, really fun, exciting, dramatic, well-acted piece of work. And I'm here with Malcolm Venville, who is the director of the new film 44-Inch Chess. Malcolm, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, now I have a few questions for you, Malcolm, and I just want to preface this to say that I'm the film critic for WBAI, but I'm also a filmmaker, so I appreciated your film on several levels, and part of your career is really, really curious to me. Now, just going to give you a little back context of my question. I'm a filmmaker. I made my last film in the year 2000, and I took time off to be a single dad, and I've been a film critic for the last 8 years, and I'm just going back now to filmmaking. And, you know, it's not that easy to work in film, take 10 years off or more, and then go back. But you've done that. How on earth did you pull this off?
Loads of commercials for his company that helped enable me to get the script.
And so what, now I know that some friends of mine, other filmmaker friends of mine have done that. They've done commercials or music videos, you know, in between, you know, after they made a feature or, you know, to pay the bills. My question is, was going back to film something you always were planning to do? And B, what kept you away from filmmaking for quite so long?
You know, I had so many projects, you know. I mean, the thing about film is you've probably experienced is the highs are incredibly high, but the lows are terrible.
Yes, they are.
And the heartbreaks involved, in the past few years, you know, setting up movies, actually going on location and prepping movies, and in the last week, the movie falling apart and everyone going away, and, you know, the last person left sitting there. And I had a few of those painful experiences, but, you know, patience is a virtue, as they say.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. Well, I loved what you did with the film, and I loved there are a number of things I loved about the film. What the part of the beauty of the film for me now, from a filmmaking standpoint, is there are only several locations. It's really all about the characters and the drama and the tension between them that make you not at all think, "Huh, this couldn't cost too much to make." All you really had, your below the line costs were very low.
Yeah, it was like, we actually made it just before the recession hit, so we had enough money to kind of make the film, you know, without actually racing and sprinting to get coverage. You know, I shot on one camera, which I'm learning now is a virtual impossibility. You know, you need to have at least two on set, you know, just because no one has any time to shoot the film properly anymore.
Right.
But I had the chance to shoot one camera, which is, it was all, everything was focused on that one camera, and so we had enough money and enough time to kind of make the film at the proper pace. I think that may have been the last of its era. I don't know.
Well, maybe. And I'm curious now, when this came across, you said your producer friend's desk, what made him think of you? What is it about your work and the content of this script that made him know it was a good match and then made it a good match for you?
Well, Steve Golin is known for establishing film directors' careers, you know, from his Propaganda days when David Fincher and Michael Bay and Spike Jonze, all these guys jumped from music videos and commercials into film. He really was part of that movement, you know, and so I think he saw in me, we worked on a few projects, he saw the chance for me to make the leap, you know, and he's a great enabler in that way, Steve.
Okay, and was there anything, though, particularly about the script for you that you know, struck a chord with you to say, you know, I really know how to make this work?
Yeah, so I instantly, you know, I think anyone who's ever been in love or anyone been in trouble in a relationship will find some power in this script. It's so, it's the bloodiness of the writing and the kind of, almost the Shakespearean quality of it that just drew me in, just the lyrical poetry of the way these guys spoke. And also confinement is interesting. As you said, you know, things that are confined can have great challenges, I think, visual challenges.
Oh, most definitely. And what I thought is also interesting is that the script is written by one of the writers is a former actor. So I've always found that scripts written by actors always have a lot of meat on the bone for the actors to sink their teeth into. So I'm curious, how difficult or easy was it for you to attract the level of talent you had? And you had amazing actors in this.
Yeah, you know what? It was Ray Winston. I'm not sure. I can never really get it out of them. But I think they wrote it for Ray, or had Ray in mind, or Ray was around when they wrote it. So Ray had director approval. So it was really, birth of the movie was my meeting with Ray when we got on like a house on fire. And so Ray is so popular in England, and the script so strong, and he was the kind of magnet to draw in, you know, John Hurt, Tom Wilkinson, and quite in the quality of the dialogue as well.
Oh, yeah, well, I thought it was great. Now, tell me a little bit about the casting and your choices. I mean, were you able to get most of the people, like, did you see most of these people in the roles? I mean, for instance, Joanne Whalley, I haven't seen her on screen in a minute, but I thought she was perfect for the role. She has that lived-in quality and was able to bring across the you know, what I thought was perfect for the character. So I thought all of your casting was pitch perfect. Tell me a little bit about casting this.
Well, you know, Joanne, as a kid, as a young film student, I watched, there's an English writer who's long dead now, Dennis Potter, wrote a TV series called The Singing Detective.
Of course, I remember it.
And I was just a young man, and Joanne Whalley had such a profound effect on me, both with her beauty and her performance and her wit, you know, that it was just an immediate, you know, it was an immediate choice, really.
Huh.
It was just my initial first choice, and she loved it.
Well, that's great. And tell me about some of the other characters. Were they all, like, did you get most of your first choices? Did you read the script and just instantly know who you wanted to place?
I know, it was so exciting because we've got very few passes, you know, very few people. I can't 100% back for this, but I think Albert Finney said it was the most, Old Man Peanut was the most disgusting part he'd ever read.
Okay.
Every actor wanted to play. You know, every actor wanted to get involved. There was no haggling around, waiting for actors' decisions. They were all in. They all wanted to do it, to act. I guess Stephen Delane's character Mal, he was the most kind of one of the most interesting choices we had to make, because he's so kind of classy as an actor. But, and I didn't see him immediately in the role of Mal, but when we met, it was just an effortless decision.
Ah. Now, tell me about your shooting style and maybe your style of directing. I mean, in commercials, you definitely have one set of skills that you need to use. You have to visually tell a lot in a very short amount of time. Tell me a little bit about how you prepared for this film, in taking advantage of the limited, you know, the confinement locations, and maybe what you do to get characters in character. I mean, you're working with actors, so you don't have to do probably quite a lot of rehearsal.
I actually got quite a bit of rehearsal on this, which is a relief. But I guess the first thing I did was to prep myself with the material, you know, so I understood the characters and the feelings of the characters, why I'm and the character's journey, you know. That's why. So I just worked hard on that, you know, because I think one of my fears, I think, is that an actor has to have total faith in the director's comprehension of the movie. So I really prepared hard at that, you know. And I guess going from commercials to film is, I actually thought the other day that being a commercial director is like being a paid flower arranger, you know. You make things look pretty and easy to look at, you know. But in 44, what I learned in commercials was film craft. It was like a really great film school, you know, and you could learn lensing and learn blocking and angles and editing and post-production. So that's why I transferred over from commercials into the movie.
Hmm. And would you say having done commercials really prepared you in some ways uniquely that you didn't expect for the challenge of a film like this?
I think so. And I think when you're in a situation where you have to make a fast choice, you know, where to put the camera, or how do I best interpret this scene visually, you know, I think hanging around shooting commercials and the pressures of shooting commercials helped me make those fast choices.
And I'm also curious, you said you did get a lot of time to rehearse. So tell me a little bit about that. Do you did you work in the space a lot? Did you allow the actors to create their own blocking? Did you have ideas? You know, I know with a commercial, you know, everything's got to be really planned out and maybe storyboarded and whatnot. Were you that meticulous in terms of doing this, or did you give them a certain freedom, or did you walk a line in between?
Well, what we did was, in the rehearsal room, was we taped out the room, you know, we had some furniture there. And I did storyboard the movie, but it's not really to my taste to storyboard movies. So I love blocking process when actors come in.